Thank you very much. As you know, Gwen and I have been discussing Norm entrepreneurship, but I think she's had the last laugh on me because I realise that my historical paper is just simply birds and bees, and you can do the theory later. What I'm going to do, or what I've done in my paper, is to talk a little bit about how the convention, the European Convention on Human Rights, was created. And in fact, as I've been listening this morning and reading in the IR literature, I'm very much aware that what I am doing is actually providing some of you clever theorists with a lot of good data. I'm also very minded by a very wise remark of Dennis Galligan in one of the many pieces he's written about human rights, that individual human rights are of themselves always subversive to the state. And I think that that big idea is something that's very important for us to keep at the back of our minds, whether we're talking about rules, norms, or rights. I should say that I'm actually working on a biography of Ernest Bevin, the British Foreign Secretary between 45 and 51, who was one of the big hitters. He wouldn't have called himself a norm entrepreneur, but one of the big hitters behind the creation of the ECHR. So I've come to this by a rather loopy and strange path, but I'm very much aware that in the traditional biographies of Bevin, there's very little on the Council of Europe, and I think this is a great mistake. The time period that I've been considering is 48, from the Hague Congress, which put forward the first of some of the early ideas for a Council of Europe, and 51. So I think those of you who are thinking about entrepreneurship should think about time frames. The time frame is actually quite narrow. I'm going, just for the purposes of my 10 minutes, to pose the question, why? Why did the ECHR come onto the agenda, reflective as it is of a lot of ideas that were well established and not so well established in different parts of Europe? We know about the traditional views about the impact of World War II, never again, that somehow the international community had to figure out a way to create the structures in which norms were so thought about that war would hopefully become impossible. I think I'd also want to say that there are a number of threads that run into the ECHR. The first one is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it is absolutely fascinating for someone who is doing research here to find out how little has been seriously researched on the connections between the two. There are big differences, and the most interesting difference is that in the ECHR, the social and economic rights that you find in the Universal Declaration have fallen by the wayside, and that is an interesting story all of its own. The second big framework or scoping arrangement is the Council of Europe, which was created in 49, and out of which the convention arises. I think in the same way as you needed the UN for the UDHR, you need the organisation before you get the set of norms or the institution, to use some people's IR definitions. I'd also like to note, and this is almost always forgotten, that the British produced their own International Bill of Rights in June 1947, which they produced to put into the UN debate. Now, foreign offices being foreign offices, they launched it at the same time as the Marshall Plan Declaration was made in June 1947. It appeared as a command paper and a banner. It even took the university here 2 days to find the International Bill of Rights. Very interesting document, of course, because it is a core document for both the UDHR and later the Council, the European Convention. So the reasons derive from the past, and they derive from a desire, a strategic desire, not to have the same kind of experience that was undertaken in the 20s and the 1930s. There's another big reason. and it's one that emerges as the debate goes on, and how the theorists would theorise about this, I don't know. But it's the cognate. And I have to say that although there are references in the Brussels Treaty Organisation of 1948, and then in the Council of Europe, the notion of human rights is one that acquires a salience in a growing Cold War context. And so by 1950, you talk about morale instinct. You talk about preserving the West against what is quoted and quoted with clandestine penetration from the Soviet Union. You talk about generating a mood of resistance. And if my understanding of IR theory is correct, I think that in a sense, what we are seeing here in a messy sort of way is a reflective process. That before we know how we fight the Cold War, we have to know who we are. And that's harder to pin down than some of the easier bits of the convention. So those for me are the why reasons. The how reasons are fascinating. And I think this is where agency, norm agency perhaps, is so effective. Low-level groups, senior politicians not involved at a high level except as their individuals. It's not a big government policy either in France or in Britain. Cabinet committees broken down into categories for different sets of rights that go into the convention. Lawyers, Eric Beckett was the most important one, attached to the Foreign Office, which is the lead department. However, this is a multi-departmental exercise with the Treasury, the Colonial Office, and the Home Office, as well as the Lord Chancellor's Office, all involved at different stages. But you can't just talk about a national level. There is constant interaction with the international level. On the one hand, with the United Nations, for the UDHR, and these two processes are in competition. And on the other, with the Council of Europe, which through its committees, assembly committees, becomes a very powerful player. And the third are the small groups of individuals, lawyers, you could call it an epistemic community, if you like. And they are extremely powerful. A lot of these people are people who have got experience. In the First World War, Cassin is one of them. They are people who are considered to be slightly on the margins. Lauterbach was not approved of in the UK because of his continental background and name. These groups, it seems to me, have managed to penetrate soft organisations that are being formed and rules that are being set up, and they work with extraordinary effectiveness. I wouldn't want to call Winston Churchill a norm entrepreneur, but actually, if you want to stick a hard label on it, that's where he is. But he is doing it for domestic reasons, to make mischief at home, just as much as to get results overseas. And I'd just like to add that on the dark side of entrepreneurship, there is an extraordinarily interesting book coming out with OUP soon by a young man called Marco Duranti. And he's looked very carefully at both the French and the English individuals. And his conclusion is that a lot of these individuals come from a position, an ideological position that is way to the right. And he hypothesizes that some of the arguments, at least at the Hague Congress, of these individuals was to set up a regime in which they would themselves not be penalized for collaboration with Vichy. Now, if you want a dark side, Christina's dark side, it don't get much darker than that. Maxwell Fyfe is another one who becomes extraordinarily right-wing in his later career. So I think that there's a very interesting point, and Calypso's point about epistemic communities is entirely taken, that we don't know enough about these roots. Cassin is another one. Cassin was acting so much as an individual that I found material in the British Foreign Office saying, shall we actually spill the beans to the French government about how far he's acting, he's playing away from home, which is quite strong stuff. So the how is small level stuff. It is individuals that matter. It is, to me, agency that matters. So if I may just... Have I got 5 minutes? 3 minutes? 2 minutes?
One minute.
Okay. The first point, we mustn't forget the domestic in the way that these new ideas are managed and come onto the international agreements. Within the UK, there is huge tension between Labour, Bevin, and the trade unions, who aren't really interested in the ECHR. What they want is full employment. And it's worth remembering that the same day the convention is signed, there is an agreement with the Council of Europe on full employment in Europe. They feel that the ECHR, in terms of property rights and other areas, is actually a right-wing ideological agenda. It's not an agenda for social democracy. So the more you look, the messier it gets. The British also took a very short-term view. They were very frightened about empire and what they called their less mature, I quote there, colonial peoples. And they wanted to manage the process of decolonisation. They certainly did not want either the UN or the other Europeans so to do. So Sabine's national structures are very important. The entrepreneurs are national, they're international, they have ideas that extend beyond the state. And in a time of great fluidity between 45 and 50, they are operating on a global and a European level. They tend to be lawyers. They tend to have Zionist Jewish backgrounds. Many have had very bad wartime experiences in the First and Second World Wars. The third point I'd make is institutional pressures. I would call it entrapment. For many in Britain and in France by 50, they couldn't say no to a convention. You could not say to the Russians, we don't want a convention on human rights, because they would have run away with the PR game. So, for whatever the motives were, they become entrapped in the institutional pressures. So institutions are sticky. And it is smaller groups that get the freedom to manoeuvre within these institutions. And just to wind up on the bigger strategic question, my sense is that human rights were seen very largely instrumentally. I disagree with Andy Muravchik, who says it's about state building. I don't think he hasn't read the primary sources, basically. I think it is to do, however, with an image of self during the early days of the Cold War. It's an image for many of the Federalists of building some kind of European unity without which you cannot stand up to the Soviet Union. And at the same time, it is reflective. The word like-minded comes into the convention, and indeed I think it's in the Council of Europe, and the idea of unity is powerful. So you find people who are like yourself, with ideas like yourself, and within that environment, leaders and their epistemic communities can push forward new ideas. Thank you very much.